If you're certain that a stock you own is cash flow safe and it's not going to be cutting its dividend, there's no reason to sell it. You can hold on to that while it continues to generate income as the defensive portion of your stock portfolio.
More than just a regular gym routine. When was the last time you checked on your financial fitness? If you're feeling like you're falling behind, Ed Sedell is here to help with The Retirement Trainer, a podcast about helping you get into better financial shape. Every week, Ed talks about things you need to know to become more financially fit for your future. Learn about things like how much money will you need, financial mistakes other people often make, and how you can avoid them. Plus, details on The Retirement Fitness Plan, a plan Ed personally created to help you get to and through retirement by focusing on five key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan when you visit egsifinancial.com and click on processes. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
Thank you for joining us. Like I said before, I have really been looking forward to this conversation, especially now, right? After the election, all the current events that are going on, we've got an awful lot to talk about for sure.
A lot has happened, but at the same time, nothing has happened.
Yeah.
So I think markets can get really, really, really carried away without reading the fine print. And I think that that's something that we should really be cognizant of.
Yeah, you know what? I agree. There's a little bit of euphoric overkill right after the election. We saw the markets take off. But, you know, when you're still looking at bond yields, I mean, it's kind of telling us a little bit maybe of a different story. You probably saw the PPI numbers, right? I mean, inflation, it's still here. It has not gone away. And I think that there's a lot of things that have to happen in order for this euphoric ride to continue. But so let me ask you that. All right. Since the election, what is your view of the markets and the economy? And has it really changed a whole lot since the election?
I think certainly the mood in the market has changed markedly. In terms of what I pay the closest attention to, which is actually what companies are doing as opposed to what companies are saying, because these are the components that comprise the eventual data. But in terms of what companies are doing, we really haven't seen a let up in layoff announcements. They keep coming every night after the markets close and companies report earnings and along with it. And we're going to cut X percent of our workforce. We're going to guide down on our revenues. That has to stop. And it's not so much companies meeting or beating their EPS estimates. Anybody can monkey with their bottom line. What we need to see right now is for companies to stop guiding down on their revenue. And that's my concern. I'm the number one proponent of cutting government waste. But I also think that markets are getting a little bit carried away with the idea that the Department of Government Efficiency, I won't use the acronym, will be able to get sufficient numbers of Democratic senators to cross the aisle in order to, let's just take a hypothetical, shut down the Department of Education.
Right.
So there are a lot of things in this country that are long overdue and need to be done. I've advocated for the past 20 years to reform the public education system, and I would be the first theoretical Democrat. I'm not a Democrat at all. But in theory, if I was a Democrat, I would cross the aisle to close the Department of Education and start from scratch. But we are talking about the same exact swamp that existed in October of 2024 that exists in November of 24. I'll believe that the swamp is willing to empty the swamp when we see Tip O'Neill, Reagan era style crossing of the aisle in order to accomplish true reforms.
Agreed. I do. I think a lot of people are looking at this as that the old saying, it's an overnight success. This is going to be long-term. It's a long-term solution. Everyone keeps talking about the first 100 days, everything's going to be great. They're going to do this, that, and the other. But really, even if you look at Trump's first term, the first year, we didn't really start seeing the effects until year two or year three down the road. But I think that there's still an awful lot of hurdles that we have to overcome before things start to get as rosy as what everyone's hoping for.
And, you know, okay, so now I was just speaking with my rational hat on. Now I'm going to sound a tad irrational, or at least a little conspiracy-esque, but it's actually a point of fact that most bureaucrats, most economists, I mean, if you look at political contributions from insiders at the Federal Reserve, for example, they're like an overwhelming 90%+ that goes to the Democratic Party. When, by the way, in an institution such as my former employer, the Fed, there shouldn't be any political contributions at all. It's against the rules and a big no-no. But my point is this. Most economists, most government bureaucrats, most traditional statisticians are very left-leaning. And speaking of statistics, if I talk to my old statistics professor at the University of Texas and say, we've had 19 straight months of negative downward revisions to private payrolls, what is the statistical probability of such an unbroken stream? Now, government jobs have created 2 or 3 months in there where you had upward revisions to non-farm payrolls, which is, of course, the biggest data report of the month. But for the private sector, we've seen 19 straight months of downward revisions to private payrolls. So if I was to ask my statistics professor, what's the probability? His answer to me would be, they don't make tails in the distribution that are long enough. And the reason that I give you this drawn out answer is I am concerned that a statistical aberration in data actually reflects a statistical impossibility, and that the left-leaning data holders in Washington, D.C., especially when they see that bureaucrats in general, their counterparts, are in the crosshairs of this new Department of Government Efficiency, my concern is we're all of a sudden going to get a swing to the pendulum to the other side, and that the left-leaning statisticians in Washington, D.C. are going to rip open the gates of hell and start to report data that they've been sweeping under the rug for a very long time, according to my former statistics professor.
You know what? That's a very valid point. Well, and my old econ professor used to say, you know, there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics, right? And we saw that. I mean, the fudging of the numbers to get the outcome to look the way that they wanted to look. But I never really thought about it like that. If with the appointment of Elon and Vivek, you know, as they go through, yeah, exposing all those numbers, the impact that that could have on the economy and the markets, that's an interesting take. All right, so let me ask you this, right? So if that happens, let's talk about a recession, okay? So if most people don't realize that the recession, by the time they realize that they're in a recession, they're almost out. So I have been under the school of thought and have been talking about this for a while, that we've been kind of in a rolling recession for a while. And so your thoughts as far as a recession now and going forward, do you know, everyone keeps talking about a soft landing, no landing, we're all good. But with the statement that you just made, where do you think we're headed?
So it's an interesting question. And just to pile on to the comment that I made earlier, every single member of the business cycle dating committee, the United States is unique. If Germany has 2 negative quarters of GDP, they call it a recession. We have the National Bureau of Economic Research, which has been around since the Truman administration, and its business cycle dating committee that calls recessions and calls recoveries well after the fact. So it's a very unique construct in the U.S. economy. And every single member of that business cycle dating committee is an Obama appointee. So just to put a punctuation point on what I was mentioning earlier. So the individuals who called the recession, as you point out rightly, long after it's begun, they're all Obama appointees. In any event, to your point, depending on what you look, how you slice and dice the data, the McKelvey rule was triggered in October of 2023. Another hard and fast rule that a colleague of mine has is once the unemployment level, the number of U.S. workers, once the number of them breaches the 10% threshold, then you're kind of in the soup. That happened in April of 2024, where the level of unemployment had risen by, had crossed that 10% threshold. So let's just say theoretically, by the time we know that we've been in recession, we've already been in recession for a year. I mean, your average recession tends to last about 12, 14 months or so. So could we be almost to the point here in about 6 months that we're looking in the rearview mirror and we're already in recovery? And that's a very valid question. We've already seen more bankruptcies than any time since 2010. So by that gauge, you know, we could be pretty far into recession and almost coming out of it. And I think that's what we have to be attentive to. And again, when I see corporate America stop cutting heads, when I see the headcount reduction finally come to an end, and by the way, COVID funding is, for all intents and purposes, over, the magnificent amount of job creation, more than 50% in the last 12 months that we've seen out of the state and local government sector, that's going to go away as well. So you have to wonder if that's going to prolong the downturn. But I think the biggest awakening for people who look to you for guidance is going to be the recognition of recession. Because the American people, I will say this, it's an economic, not a political statement. The American people sense that they've been gaslighted for so long by the media that they came out and voted in droves for change.
Absolutely.
They've been lied to that there's been no recession. It'll be interesting to see how markets react when we're finally recognizing that recession, because that's when risky asset markets do tend to step back. It's the stock market that's always the last to know and the last to reflect recession, even if we've been in one theoretically since, call it, April of 2024.
You know what? You're absolutely right. And I think one of the things that's really been underreported is the savings rates have gone down. The number of deficiencies, credit cards, car loans, and bankruptcies are up significantly, like you said, since 2010. I mean, I think credit card debt is over $1.3-1.4 trillion, and people are using those credit cards just to be able to live. So that's another sign of a recessionary time.
And we're going to actually have student loans.
Yeah, golly.
In arrears, they're going to be reported to the Experian and the TransUnions of the world. They're going to be reported at the end of the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
So call it another 6 weeks, the first time since 2020 that people have potentially been in arrears for all of that time, 4 years, for heaven's sake. All of a sudden, that's going to hit the credit reports of maybe 20 million Americans who are estimated to not be making their student loan payments. That's going to come on top of delinquent auto loans, as you point out, deficiencies in credit card lending, which we've seen rise to the highest level in well over a decade.
So let's talk about, you mentioned jobs and, you know, obviously the revision downward last spring. But let's also talk about the jobs that were added. I would say close to, if not a little bit more than half of all jobs that were reported were government jobs, which is inflationary by definition because the government doesn't produce or do anything other than it's an expense center. So as Elon and Vivek go through and they make the government more efficient, what impact do you think that that's going to have on inflation, on the recession? Is there a way to stave that off? Or do you think it's going to be null and void? It's really not going to have an impact one way or the other.
Well, again, I'm going to go back to being pragmatic here. You're going to have to get the Democrats to cross the aisle in order to, with respect to Elon and Vivek. I met with Vivek at his headquarters in Columbus, Ohio. We spoke about reforming the Fed with respect for the spirit of what they want to accomplish, which, by the way, the American people deserve. The slim majority in the House of Representatives, the slim majority in the Senate, the requirement that you get a majority vote in order to enact these changes leaves me skeptical that they will actually be legislated and voted upon. But let's take the hypothetical. Let's take the hypothetical of taking the highest paid, least skilled workers out of the workforce. That would be highly disinflationary. That would really be a depressant on prices. And I certainly don't think the bond market is looking at it that way. But again, the stickiest form of inflation is wage inflation. The most highly compensated employees in America who don't necessarily garner the wages that they make are government employees. You start cutting them and you're going to have a very disinflationary impulse created by that. Absolutely, without a doubt. And that's why I think that they're talking about several year severance packages, not a matter of months, but actually trying to make it more palatable to get the number of votes that they need in order to really begin reforming the federal government by providing voluntary buyouts that last for several years to give would-be former government employees enough runway to land a new job, theoretically. That might end up being bipartisan in nature if they were to craft it in such a way that you had voluntary attrition, the same way Verizon just announced a $2.9 billion severance charge, yet they never announced a single layoff. Why is that? Because 4,800 employees left by attrition with large severance packages. The U.S. government could take the same tack as the private sector.
I think that makes probably the most sense, right? I did hear an interview, Bill Ackman came up with an idea as far as the long severances. You have to actually inspire people or incentivize them to actually go look for another job. And let's just say, for argument's sake, right, the severance is 24 months. We saw this with COVID and all the COVID money. People waited until the very end before they did anything, right? So, hey, if you get a job in the first 2 months or 3 months or 6 months, we're still going to pay you the balance of whatever that severance is to incentivize people to basically double dip. And I think that that would have a positive outcome as well for exiting other than through attrition. I actually listened to that this morning. I thought that that was a very ingenious way of looking at it, you know, as far as shrinking the government. Now, okay, so I want to talk about your book because I think it's very important now with everything that's going on. You were at the Fed for 9 years. Your book, which I love the title, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. What compelled you to write the book after having been there for 9 years?
Well, today, I think that there are some measures of inflation that skew the data higher than they would otherwise be in terms of being a reflection of Fed policy. You have the prices of goods that we would consider to be discretionary in nature really falling at the fastest pace since the Great Depression, because as they say, interest rates are a blunt tool. And the Fed has done what it can do to bring prices down, but it has no impact on regulators allowing auto insurance rates to rise. The Fed policy has similarly zero impact on the fact that our homeowners insurance has risen to the extent that it has, or the cost of healthcare. These are simply not prices that are very essential to Americans that we must pay. These are not prices over which Fed policy can have any effect. That being said, Fed policy does affect asset prices. It affects the prices of office towers and residential real estate and the stock market. And it was during 2009, 2010 that the Fed recognized that the inflation metrics that it was following failed to capture in the run-up to the Great Recession in 2004, 2005, 2006, that the inflation metrics weren't broad enough to capture the runaway housing bubble and the run-up in residential real estate prices. So after 2 years of gnashing our teeth internally when I was there at the Fed, they decided that they did need a new mousetrap, that they did need to fully capture inflation, and then they did absolutely nothing about it. Because then they wouldn't have been able to hide behind quantitative easing and maintain artificially low interest rates. So even though they, Houston, we have a problem, the Fed decided to not do anything to address it. And that was what truly made me fed up enough for this clinically hyperactive gal to sit down for 2.5 years and focus enough to write a book.
Oh, wow. 2.5 years. Holy cow. All right. So
the book is full of mostly their words, not mine, which took a lot of documentation.
All right. So what is, from your vantage point, what do you think the role of the Fed is and what should it be?
So I think the role of the Fed needs to be cut in half. I think that the inflation mandate, trying to minimize price pressures, inherently conflicts with trying to maximize employment. They literally move in two different ways if you're studying how the types of economic data points that they are. Mm-hmm. So I think it needs to be recognized that the expansion of the mandate in 1978 needs to be rolled back simply to protecting the buying power of people's incomes. And being a lender of last resort in times of, gee, here's the 1907 financial crisis that J.P. Morgan recognized his fallibility and said, I'm not going to be around forever. I'm going to die at some point. We're no longer an emerging nation. We're a developed nation. And it's time for us to have a central bank in the event of overspeculation bubbling over and a banking crisis threatening to take down the system such that we act as a very temporary very temporary backstop on the financial system, on the banking system. I'm talking about months, not years, not quantitative easing, not blowing up the balance sheet. So I think the zero interest rate policy that was enacted needs to be, I think the Fed needs to be accountable for its actions and declare that to have been a failed policy. The same with quantitative easing, the same with quantitative easing in terms of mortgage-backed securities, that's credit easing. The Fed should have never engaged in that. I think the Fed's role needs to be shrunken dramatically to where it's solely protecting the buying power of people's income and being lender of last resort in terms of true financial turmoil, systemic risk being unleashed, and then regulating the banking system. That's part of their duty and their role to make sure banks aren't going crazy, as well as potentially the Chinese moving in and doing what they did to U.S. intellectual property, but inside of our banking system and potentially attacking it from within cyber-wise. So very much a shrunken role for the Federal Reserve going forward. I hope that Vivek begins to, I'm happy to talk to him about it again, begins to look to reforming the Fed because mandate creep really has infected the institution.
I agree completely. Now, what do you think about transparency and full disclosure of the Feds? I think that has been missing for a while as they've, like you said, they've been creeping, adding to their mandate throughout the decades.
I think Congress has a duty to restate where the Fed can and cannot go. It is Congress's purview, if the people deem that legal, to introduce as a digital currency. It is the purview of the Treasury Department, certainly not that of the Fed, to be recruited to play a role of big brother. Congress should mandate that the Fed not play a role in addressing climate change. I mean, these are things that shouldn't have to be said. But yet, if you look on certain Federal Reserve District websites, you'll see that the Chicago Federal Reserve is addressing things like climate change. And I think that that needs to be explicitly prohibited in the stricture that these mandates need to be added to the Federal Reserve Act to exclude the feds having any participation in areas that should be handled by scientists or the Treasury Department or Congress.
Yeah, because I mean, it really is an overreach in every aspect. So, all right, I've got to ask you this because, all right, where did the feds come up with this 2% target? I mean, it almost seems arbitrary. I talked with Art Laffer earlier in the year, and that's what he said. Steve Forbes says the same thing. I mean, what is the purpose of that 2% inflation rate? Where did that target come from?
So the 2% inflation rate existed in other countries prior to the United States. It was kind of accepted in the academic community as being a low enough target to not be too inflationary. But to answer your question, yes, it does appear to be arbitrary, but it also reflects this deep down fear of deflation. And it is central bankers' ultimate boogeyman. They lose sleep overnight about the prospect of declining prices in an environment of unprecedented over-leverage. And when you have falling prices and very high leverage, then your obligations actually increase as a factor of time. But there's no single tool in the Fed. Interest rates cannot affect deflation. And it can't. So it really, to me at least, reflects central bankers' longstanding fear of their incapacity to fight deflation, which is, of course, what dragged the world economy into the Great Depression years and years ago. It was a steady decline in prices against a backdrop of massive overleverage.
Best explanation I have heard. Yep. Okay. I like that. All right. So now comes the question, right? We heard it from Janet Yellen, Jerome Powell. We were in a, you know, inflation is transitory. It's really not here. And then all of a sudden it's here. We all of a sudden had inflation at a 40-year high. So I wanted to say that to preface my question is, how do you think Powell has performed throughout his tenure as president? I know it's a tough job, but you having been in the Fed for 9 years as an insider, what's your take on his tenure so far?
I think that Powell made several mistakes when the pandemic first hit. The magnitude of quantitative easing was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And completely overblown, and it went on for way too long. When it comes to transitory, it's a very long story. It's quite inside baseball. The Biden administration was trying to bring Lael Brainard on to replace Jay Powell so that progressive policies could be enacted. And that moment in time, which lasted for more than 1 year, while transitory kind of hung out there in the wind, the crisis of confidence in the potential future leadership of the Fed divided the staff and caused a lack of policy traction at the time. Half of the staff was saying that inflation was going to be transitory. The other half of the staff was saying that inflation was stickier than what it had appeared that it was first going to be. But my point to you is it's an extremely long and drawn out answer. The minute the Senate reconfirmed Jay Powell, the minute, the day of, literally the day of the vote, he went on NPR. He did an at-length interview. He mentioned the 2% inflation target 14 times, and he disposed of the word transitory. But the Biden administration put Powell out to dry and left him hanging in the wind without knowing whether or not he was first going to be renominated and second going to be reconfirmed. The time between he was renominated and reconfirmed by the Senate was 6 months, over which period the Biden administration was able to stack the Federal Reserve Board with very progressive policymakers while they held Powell hostage. So transitory was, if you understand history, and it will be written one day, transitory is not at the footstep of Jay Powell, but actually others on the Federal Reserve Board staff that insisted it was going to be that way. But again, the staff was divided at the time in allegiance to Lael Brainard, who wanted and believed in the transitory narrative. So that's my very long answer. That being said, he completely overreacted after the pandemic hit. He should have backed away from quantitative easing much earlier than he did after the pandemic hit. And never should the process of blowing up the Fed's balance sheet have been able to extend and persist for as long as it did, such that we're now looking at multiple years of runway to get the Federal Reserve's balance sheet back down to a normal size.
Great explanation. Actually, again, probably that makes a whole lot more sense to me. I never really thought about the NPR interview, but yeah, thinking back, yeah, that's exactly it. That makes perfect sense. All right. So do you think the Feds are going to continue to lower rates? I mean, they just lowered them 25 basis points. Do you see another 25 in December? And do you think they're going to continue? Because if we look at, well, we saw the PPI numbers today. Inflation is still here, like we talked about earlier. The bond yields are showing that, inflation is still here. So what are your thoughts on that?
So I think that they go in December for sure. I think that the first 100 basis points is a given. It is exceedingly rare to see the Fed pause in a tightening cycle, which we recently witnessed. Mm-hmm. And it's exceedingly rarer to see the Fed pause in an easing cycle. Normally, you inject as much easing into the system as what is required for there to be no inflationary impulse and no need to continue with layoffs. We call it the neutral rate. Because I'm of the mind that the statisticians are going to pick up the carpet and pull out all the dust they've been dusting underneath the carpet in the form of withheld negative data, shall we say, because I think that that's going to happen. And also because of the fact that the Fed's formal legal inflation target is headline PCE, which hit 2.1% in September and appears to be, it's going to stay 2.1% or actually hit 2.0%. The core is going to be 2.6, 2.7%. But, Powell is rational enough to mention in 3 month annualized rates, 6 months annualized rates of inflation. And, when the CPI hit, what we saw was that the six-month annualized rate of CPI is 1.4%. So unless corporate America stops firing people, and unless there's some kind of immaculate disappearance of all bad data from the statisticians, if they don't start to report bad data, which I believe they will, I believe that they're going to be as cruel as they can to this incoming administration. So if that's the case, and Powell and company are faced with actual negative data, in addition to a continued dissipation in the rate of inflation, I think they continue to ease in 2025.
All right. So let's talk about bond yields, right? Because people are looking at bond yields going up, mortgage rates going up, the Fed rate is going down. So Why do you think the bond yields are going up and saying we're seeing continued inflationary pressure? I mean, do you think that that's based on reality or just possibilities in the future and in future policies?
So at the risk of giving you one more fairly drawn out answer, the concepts of stock versus flow, this was discussed a lot inside the Fed because the market would pitch a hissy fit during the initial phase of quantitative easing. Every time the Fed would get close to tapering quantitative easing or slowing quantitative, the market would pitch a hissy fit. No. We want more QE at the margins. So the market was demanding flow, more liquidity into the system, as opposed to stock, which is holding the size of the Fed's balance sheet static using reinvestment. I think the current backdrop is born of the ability for dramatic tariffs to be introduced yesterday. And it's confusing the idea of stock versus flow when it comes to the extension of the 2017 tax cuts. That at the margin is not going to pump money into U.S. household bank accounts. It's simply going to prevent the damage that would be done by raising tax rates. But that doesn't inject marginal liquidity into the system. It doesn't create inflation. And if there are to be tariffs enacted, and my fingers are crossed as we tape this, that it is Scott Bessent, who is appointed to be Treasury Secretary. Goodbye, Janet Yellen. But if it is somebody rational like a Scott Bessent, who's going to give American manufacturers, call it 2 years, he has said, I'm going to give you 2 years to relocate your supply chain closer to home. Friendshoring, nearshoring, onshoring. So I'm going to give you 2 years to make your best effort to relocate your supply chains away from our sovereign economic enemies, i.e. China, back towards the United States. And if you do that in 2 years' time, I'm going to be kind to you after you start to build a factory and not impose tariffs. And that, to me, is a way to go about a long-term permanent shift away from the threat posed by keeping our supply chains in China is to reward companies carrot stick by saying, build the factory, we won't impose the tariffs. But my point to you is you're asking me about bond yields. Bond yields today reflect a credit trade. Bond yields today reflect investors who are trying to imply that the tariffs are going to occur overnight, be draconian, be massive, and cause inflation to be ignited in the blink of an eye. It doesn't work that way. The political capital that Majority Leader John Thune is going to use from the state of South Dakota is going to be first to extend those tax cuts. That's going to be the first order of business. But again, that's not going to inject any liquidity into the system in the same way that an average American family was getting $3,000 a month if they had three or four kids in child tax credit cash deposited into their checking accounts. That created inflation. Much different way of injecting liquidity into the system that does create inflation in a very fast fashion, because if you get $3,000 in child tax credit every single month, you're going to Disneyland, you're spending more money on filet mignon, you're trading up, you're doing all kinds of things that are immediately inflationary.
All right. I agree completely. All right, here's the last question I have for you, because you're kind of very well known for your take on the housing market and the supply and demand. As rates are still kind of holding, right? They haven't really come down yet. I think they're going to start coming down next year once the reality hits and bond yields start coming down. It looks like across the country, from Florida to Texas, where you're at, we're starting to see inventories kind of increase. Even here in Columbus, Ohio, we're starting to see an increase in inventories. But where do you see the housing market over the next couple of years or during this administration? Because if rates go down, the housing prices are going to go up, and it's a very, very tight market right now. So are you positive on the outlook?
So I think that a natural cause, a Mother Nature caused event, is going to have profound impacts on the residential real estate market. And why is that? We're seeing bank lending standards for mortgages tighten up. Banks are in the third or fourth inning of taking commercial real estate charge-offs, taking auto loan charge-offs, taking credit card charge-offs. So that process has yet to be seen through. And they're also, as a result of their loan books being impaired and shrinking, they're clamping down on lending standards. So if they see a household that's got too much credit card debt and too much auto debt, they're going to be stingier when it comes to making a new mortgage. I bring this up because of Mother Nature. The path of Hurricane Beryl has seen delinquencies in the affected Texas counties increase by more than one full percentage point. And then you had Helene and Milton, and they blasted a trail through Airbnb jock territory that's just biblical. And there was going to come a time that overnight millionaires who were taking TikTok seminars on how they too could quit their day jobs and become real estate magnates, there was always going to come a time that that party ended. My message to you is that Hurricanes Beryl, Helene, and Milton are expediting the end of financing to this investor cohort. And because you're going to have so many investor properties pour onto the market, which is exactly what we're seeing, as you rightly note, in Texas, it's exactly what we're seeing on top of what's going on with the disaster with homeownership maintenance costs in the state of Florida, on top of their property taxes, on top of HOA fees going up, on top of insurance going through the roof. Investors are also starting to dump their properties there, as well as right through North Carolina, where there had been a lot of investment properties purchased. Those investment properties can only be maintained by virtue of constantly regenerative mortgage financing. That's going away. So if we see the investors pull back, if we see many companies follow Amazon and Goldman Sachs and require their employees to be back in the office 5 days a week, which we are seeing, and therefore people no longer being able to afford the home that they bought in the exurbs right after the pandemic hit in Boise or wherever, if we see this confluence of events along with layoffs, I think that we will see, to your point, supply continue to increase as we see the unemployment rate rise into 2025, and that will have a greater effect on residential real estate than falling mortgage rates will have.
So when do you think is a good time to buy? I know that's the million-dollar question that everyone always asks you, so I've got to ask it because everyone wants to know.
It's not a cop-out in any way, shape, or form, but location does matter. So whoever bought in Austin 2 years ago is licking his or her wounds, because it was Austin that was the most invaded by investors, that was the most overbuilt, that turned the first, where oversupply started to push so much inventory onto the market that you could really start to bargain for the home price. And we're seeing follow through in Houston, in Dallas, in San Antonio, in Florida. And it will come to your neck of the woods, the Midwest, probably the latest, because there wasn't some massive push to build out huge suburbs and exurbs in the Midwest. So homes are scarcer on a relative basis where you are. So I think we'll see waves of supply coming online in the United States, and that depending on where you want to live, you need to pay very close attention simply to the month supply. In Texas, we've already gone past 2019 levels. And we keep on going. So there's only one direction for Texas home prices to follow, and that's down. Inventory up, prices down. It's supply and demand. But pay close attention to wherever you might want to live or wherever you may want to relocate to get that better job, and pay close attention to when inventory crosses a certain threshold. And when it does, when it surpasses that 2019 level, it goes from being a seller's market to a buyer's market. It's pretty simple.
Awesome. Great. Where would you put your money? As the new administration takes hold, they get sworn in over the next 4 years, where are you investing?
So look, stocks have been overvalued for a very long time. Revaluation is not a timing mechanism. But as we mentioned earlier, when recession is finally recognized by the stock market, which is typically well after it's begun, then you finally get the true correction that we've all been waiting for in risky asset prices. And I think that that is in front of us. So it's with good reason that we're actually having this conversation several hours after money market fund assets crossed the $7 trillion mark for the first time. Even though, as we know, Federal Reserve is lowering interest rates, and yet people are piling into the safety of cash. So I happen to own quite a few municipal bonds, not in Illinois, but in areas of the Midwest that happen to know how to run a municipality or run a state government. I still own my gold, but that's a core holding as well. But I think you're still being paid somewhere in the neighborhood of 5% to be a spectator. And I think that that's okay. I do. It's boring. It's boring. But I will take you back to my statistics professor's probability of 21 straight months or 19 straight months, whatever it is, of downward revisions to private payrolls being a statistical impossibility. If we're about to release the Kraken in terms of U.S. data, I think that a front row seat on the sidelines is a pretty good place to be right now, as well as any company that you are quite certain. I was listening to the CEO of Chevron. I'm not vouching for his stock, but I was listening to the CEO of Chevron a few days ago say it's been 70 years. We've never cut our dividend. So if you're certain that a stock you own is cash flow safe and it's not going to be cutting its dividend, there's no reason to sell it. You can hold on to that while it continues to generate income as the defensive portion of your stock portfolio.
Danielle, thank you so much. I want to be respectful of your time. I think we kind of ran over a little bit, but I really do appreciate your insights, and I'd love to have you back on the podcast sometime soon.
I would as well. Enjoy this fall in Dayton, and I really do thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
You tested your fitness level, not your workout routine. I'm talking about your financial endurance, because if saving to a 401k is the extent of your effort, it is time for you to start shaping up. And Ed Sedell is here to help you do that with The Retirement Trainer. It's his podcast to help you examine your financial stamina and learn the questions you should be asking and areas to focus on to help you get to that place you've been working so hard for, a happy, comfortable retirement. And it's not as hard as some might have made you believe. Ed's broken it down into 5 simple steps. It's the retirement fitness plan, which he personally created to help clarify key areas of your financial life. Learn more about the retirement fitness plan at egsifinancial.com. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to the Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Investment advisory services offered through EGSI Investment Management, DBA EGSI Financial Group, a registered investment advisor. Insurance and annuities offered through EGSI Financial Services, Inc., Ohio License Number 102-06-19.